Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me, this time, is co-host Joel Torres.
Hello.
Hi, Joel. Could you tell everyone out there who you are and where people might have heard you?
Sure. My name is Joel Torres. I have my own little podcast called Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, where we every week cover science fiction and fantasy movie podcasts. I've also guested and hosted on A Talking Cat, The Cast Next Door, and As If, the Clueless Minute-by-Minute podcast.
This time, we are doing Rudolfo Anaya's 1972 novel, Bless Me, Ultima, which was a book that Joel suggested to me. And I have to admit, was not a book I read in high school. As I've mentioned before, I went to high school in the very smallest town in the middle of central Illinois, and they were very, very white. And and as I was, this was a book whose name I had heard before, but I didn't know anything about it. And as I did some research on it, I found that this is a book right up the alley of Sophomore Lit, in that it is taught in high schools and middle schools, presumably more enlightened high schools and middle schools than mine, all over the country. Joel, what was your background with this book, and why were you interested in it?
Well, I think I literally read this book in my sophomore year, although it might have been my junior year. Let's not get too specific. All high school blends together for most Americans. That is my case. I had a teacher that year that was giving us things that I had never seen before on the list. Like, we read Bless Me, Ultima, which I'd never heard anyone talk about. She also gave us Black Boy that year, which was another book that I just, like, devoured. I couldn't get enough of, like, seeing this side of life that I had no idea what was going on, and the way it was written was very absorbable. Bless Me, Ultima is kind of simply written in a way, especially compared to things like, you know, in those years you'd be reading something like Shakespeare, and you'd be reading things like The Great Gatsby, which I consider even now to be a little dense to get exactly what the author is going for. But Bless Me, Ultima is very simply written, and because I live in Southern California, there were certain things that I, like, immediately identified with, like conditions and the way people acted in the book, and certain spiritual things that people talk about, that I, now it occurs to me as an adult, oh, I guess the rest of the world didn't actually feel that way. So I would be very curious to find out, like, if other people read these books throughout the country and were like, huh, that doesn't make any sense.
I think it's true what you say about this book being very simply written. I would say in concert with that, it's very sincerely written. There's the emotion, the directness of the writing, it's just kind of bare there on the page, which is quite refreshing if you're someone like me who reads a lot of books that are steeped in irony or require you take a point of view that is a kind of a privileged point of view. This is a very earnest book. Rudolfo Anaya, by the way, this was his first novel. I don't know much about him other than what little I read in preparing for this podcast. He went through a lot of publishers and was only able to publish this book when he got the backing of some fellow Mexican Americans, and they kind of published it in a small small press, and it's become this big book in the Mexican American community, and became sort of a foundational novel for at the same time in the 1970s when there was, I think, a lot of interest in other aspects of multiculturalism. There was, of course, this flowering of awareness in the United States of the Hispanic tradition in North America. And this was around the same time as Cesar Chavez, wasn't it? You know, we think of the counterculture, we think of the civil rights movement leading into the women's rights movement. There was also a growing awareness of Hispanic culture in the United States at that time. And I think that was aligned with the labor movements in California at the time. So it was a good time to be writing this kind of a book. Okay. So this book is about a young boy, Antonio, growing up in the 1940s at the end of World War II in New Mexico. And New Mexico, I believe, had only been admitted as a state in something like 1916. It had been a part of the United States, but it had been a territory. So it was kind of a new state by the 40s. In any case, it was still a state that was largely populated by Spanish speakers, but becoming more a part of the United States. And this is reflected in the story that because this is a story, I think, a lot about identity and about where you belong. And the other thing to note is, of course, that at the end of World War II, New Mexico was where the atom bomb was first tested and detonated. And that's mentioned, I believe, once in this book, but I think it looms over a lot of what happens too.
The way that Antonio has to deal with the tons of influences in his life, and you see how his parents are acting, and his father's constant talk about the Llano and the changing of everything, his brothers who long to move out of this place that they already consider to be a dead end for them when they return from the war later in the book. It's just such a strange thing. Like, there are parts of Southern California, and I remember this from my childhood, that I felt like, and I should say this up front, I am half Mexican, and I was never educated in Spanish. I never learned Spanish, even though my father was a Spanish teacher, because just like in this book, they kind of wanted everyone to learn English, because English was the language that, you know, is the United States. That's the one that's most important, even in the 80s and into the, you know, in the 90s, an emphasis on learning English and possibly just leaving Spanish behind. And, like, they talk about his sisters in this book basically only speaking English, not really speaking Spanish, I believe. And that is a reflection of them living in New Mexico, New Mexico becoming more and more United States instead of Mexico. I don't really know where I'm going at this. These are the things that I see in it when I was reading it.
Llano is the Spanish term for the largely grassless plains of New Mexico, which are the good for cattle grazing mostly. Antonio's father, Gabriel, comes from his father's name is Mares, which is related to the sea, in Spanish, and he represents this kind of an influence over Antonio, which is vagabond and constantly restless and moving and in love with the land, and also pagan, whereas his mother comes from the family Luna, which of course means moon, And that in this book represents the world of the village and of civilization and culture, and specifically Catholicism. Both cultures do not only have different ways of living, they have different metaphysics about the universe.
Poor Antonio. Poor Antonio in this book. He just, I mean, how old, does it say specifically how old he's supposed to be in this?
He is 6 years old, and the only way that you know that is because one of the major plot points of the novel is he has his first communion, which is traditionally at age 7. Following time in this book is a little difficult. I don't think that there's one point where the kids throw a Christmas pageant and there's snow, and that's about the only thing you get in this book that kind of represents the passage of time.
We do see that he moves on from his first year of school at a certain point and onto the next class, gets moved forward some grades. So, and he talks about summertime at least twice, because he goes down to the Luna farm. The way he is in constant turmoil of who he's going to be and who he's told he has to be and what is important and stuff like that is just so mind-numbing. At age 6, if somebody, if I was constantly being torn in direct, like, not just two, not mother and father, but you got the Calandera stuff from Ultima, you've got the church. I mean, obviously his mom is doing the church, but she's not only pushing the church, she's pushing the life of the Lunas, which is the farmers. You know, they grow the best. And then you've got the Llano, the passion of the Llano. And, you know, he's seen his father constantly depressed all the time. His father drinks all the time because he can't be out there anymore. He's chosen the family life. And it's, that is so much pressure.
Well, what I said before about this being an earnest book, this has that earnestness of childhood insofar as Antonio, he's very credulous. He will believe whatever he's told by adults because adults should have their act together. The church tells him one thing, and when his friends suggest another way of seeing the world, he is torn up inside about what that means, particularly since the stakes are so high. He comes from a very fire and brimstone kind of Catholicism where the priest doesn't particularly, he's not particularly interested in teaching the finer points of theology or the Catholic catechism. He just wants the kids to kind of toe the line. So he's very happy to scare them with eternal damnation as much as he can.
Or purgatory. Which, yeah.
The occasion for the start of the story is that the titular Ultima is coming to live with the Mares Luna family. Ultima is an elderly curandera, a folk healer. Some would say a bruja, a witch. She knows a lot of folk ways that are associated, I think most specifically with the indigenous people of Mexico, a lot of things having to do with herbal healing, but also with spell casting. She's reached impoverished circumstances. She's late in life. She needs someone to look after her. And Ultima has an interesting history with Antonio. In the first of many dream sequences in the book, Antonio is constantly having these dream sequences. He dreams of his own birth. And after he's born, there are competing traditions about what to do with the afterbirth. The Mares believe that the afterbirth should be burned and the ashes should be scattered into the plains so that he will be tied to the land. And the Lunas believe that the afterbirth needs to be buried in the ground so that he's tied to the farm. And there's such a commotion over this that Ultima, who was there at the birth and who acted as a midwife, says that she will take care of the afterbirth and only she will know what Antonio's eventual fate will be. And lo and behold, when he wakes up, Antonio asks his mother, "Was Ultima there at my birth?" And the mother says, yes, she was. We're very quickly introduced into sort of the importance of dreams in this book. If you're not the kind of person who likes very literal dreams, you're going to have trouble with this book, because this book, the dreams are not subtle at all. There's no question, I think, either in Antonio's mind, nor should there be any questions in the reader's mind, because too many things turn out to be true about his dreams.
He is having visions through his dreams, not only of what is happening right now in his life, but yeah, what is going to happen in the future, what has happened in the past. And I mean, the way a person has dreams, you usually wake up and you have a vague memory of what's going on. In his dreams, people are talking to him and telling him, oh, you're going to die, or oh, we're going to die. like, wow, man, once again, those, you know, nobody likes stress dreams.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of magic in this world. I think this would fit very comfortably into the tradition of magical realist literature, insofar as it's a world in which magic is real and nobody questions that. Nobody wonders about that. It's just one more thing you have to deal with in your life. This is one of the things that's kind of interesting about the book, because as the book progresses, one of the major conflicts in Antonio's mind is the relative truth of the teachings of the Catholic Church, which denies any element of the supernatural in the world aside from that is the realm of God and the saints, and the tradition of Ultima, in which there are any number of gods and forces and ghosts in the world. But as an outsider reading this book, all I could think of is, well, obviously these things are real in the world of the book. You know, there's a curse is given, Ultima lifts a curse, and there's a result. It's the Dana Scully problem. It's sort of like, how do you remain skeptical in the face of what you actually see?
It took a lot of seasons for that to work through for her. And, you know, who knows how long it's going to be for Tonio to get over it. I mean, as you said before, he believes what adults tell him. And he actually believes what almost anybody tells him, with the exception of some of his dumber friends, you know. But did you feel that it was weird that his mother was so religious, like comically religious, in my opinion, always saying Jesus, Maria, and El San, you know, whatever, and constantly going to pray anytime something good happened, anytime something bad happened, and she didn't seem to have any issue with the magic that was happening because of Ultima's works, like right under her nose.
Yes and no. I think that if you look at this book, Antonio's conflict, if his basic conflict is between the religious traditions of Europe and the religious traditions of indigenous Mexico, this is about making a sort of an uneasy truce between those two. That, of course, is the sort of state of I think, of Mexican Catholicism today. There's been a lot of incorporation of indigenous tradition into the Mexican Catholic tradition. Today you have cults like Santa Muerte that aren't traditionally Catholic, but they have become part of the Catholic tradition. The book spends a while referencing the Virgin of Guadalupe, which is, I think, a great example of the way that I think it's kind of built into Catholicism, in spite of the fact that the priest in this book tends to take a very hard line about what is or is not Catholic. I think that in reality, Catholicism has been so successful extending its influence in the world, partly because it does find room for local customs and traditions to become part of the overall mystery of the church. One of the first major incidents in the books, there's a local war veteran named Lupito, who is having a kind of a post-traumatic stress event, and he kills
the sheriff,
right? The sheriff, who happens to be the uncle of one of Antonio's friends, and there's a manhunt, and Antonio is out watching the manhunt go on, and he sees Lupito shot by the river, and dying Lupito asks Antonio to hear his confession, and this completely wigs Antonio out because he can't do that. He believes, not being a priest, he's not able to administer extreme unction. And Lupita dies. And so this is one of the first of several deaths that poor Antonio has to deal with throughout the book.
Jeez.
He worries a lot about this because in his mind, if Lupito had been able to get to a priest as he was dying and give his confession, he would be okay. But since only Antonio was there, he worries that Lupito is going to go to hell. Or interestingly enough, he relates him to the tradition of La Llorona, the famous wailing woman ghost in Mexican tradition, who lives by rivers because her children were killed in a river,
mm-hmm.
and supposedly will drown kids. Mexican folklore seems pretty bleak to me sometimes.
You know, but we just got to keep kids away from the river. I think that's right. Did you guys have a version of La Llorona when you were growing
no,
up?
No. My version of La Llorona was I was sent to the YWCA to learn how to swim.
Okay, well. La Llorona was not in the pool there. I remember specifically in the sixth grade, I went to school in a very small town called Piru. And towards the end of the year, we would walk to a nearby park and just spend the day, you know, hanging out at the park, you know, have our lunch there, all that stuff while the teachers watched us. And there was a river that was within walking distance of the park. And I remember just being totally creeped out because people were talking about, oh, La Llorona. That's what you can hear, La Llorona, during the night over by that river. And she's calling for her children. She's calling, you know, and she'll drown you. Like, people have drowned in that river. So, you know, you might see her today. It's really scary. And, like, you know, I'm a kid, so naturally this is 100% true. And it's just really terrifying.
La Llorona was also the name of Hopi Glass's rock band in Love and Rockets.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk a little bit more about Love and Rockets later, but that was that's one connection there for fans of the Hernandez brothers. After this, Antonio has a talk with Ultima, and he asks her why Lupito had to die and whether Lupito is going to go to hell. And Ultima says that it's not really up to people to decide this. And he has a dream that night about his three older brothers. His three older brothers, by the way, have been off fighting World War II.
Antonio rushes back after witnessing Lupito being killed. By his father, by the way, is on the bridge, and so are a bunch of the other townspeople. And his father, while on the bridge, is trying to be a voice of reason with the other people, along with the town drunk, whose name I'm drawing a blank on. Anyway, they're saying, maybe we can talk to Lupito. We don't have to kill him. And of course, people, he killed the sheriff, so they want blood for blood. So naturally, as we've already talked about, it goes to the point where they do end up shooting Lupito. And Antonio has that, frankly, horrifying scene where Lupito is begging him to hear his confession, and his blood is in the river, staining the river forever, as far as Antonio is concerned. He runs back to home. And Ultima does something that she does several times in the book, where she takes out the herbs and some lotion she's made from the plants, and she's applying them to Antonio to calm him down. And it's like working her magic like that is, I think, something that happens, you know, it happens a couple of times in the book. And I think it's anytime Ultima has to handle a situation, she's got this calmness about her, this wisdom, which I like. The whole reason Ultima came to the house is because she couldn't handle something because she was getting older. And I think it's like this. Ultima seems to be the most put together of the people in this book.
One of the things that marks this and marks Ultima's wisdom is that she reserves judgment. She is not interested in passing judgment on anyone, and that's so antithetical to Antonio's crisis in life, which is he's constantly trying to determine who's right and who's wrong and who's going to hell and who's going to heaven. And Ultima just doesn't engage in that way. And I think that that's what makes her so good for Antonio. And I think what makes her an interesting hero in that she...
There's only a few passages I highlighted in this, and one of them before that is talking about his mother's reluctance to see Antonio grow up, because the part I have highlighted is it was a sin to grow up and be a man.
There's a few sequences in here where we get to see the town. What is the town is called Guadalupe, and Joel, we were talking beforehand that this town reminds me so much of Palomar from Gilbert Hernandez's Heartbreak Soup comics in Love and Rockets, in that it is so archetypal in many ways. There's the school, there's the church, and there's also a brothel, Rosie's, in the town that the children are taught to stay clear of. Mm-hmm. And there's a saloon that's run by the evil guy,
Tonero,
right? When you think about it, it kind of beggars belief that all these factions of good and evil are so closely together in what appears to be maybe like two blocks of town or something like that.
Yeah, I can't get a clear idea of how big or how small the area is. I mean, when they say they live on the edge of town because the father wanted to be, it seems like he wanted to be closer to the Llano than would be if they lived in the middle of the city. And he has to cross a bridge when he's going to school, which on the other one side of the bridge is Rosie's, right? And there is a way to get to town past that his brother, when he comes back from the war, takes to go to work. But Tonerio's bar, sorry, my cat just jumped on the table, get away. Tonerio's bar seems to be closer to his uncle's farm, because when a conflict later happens, that's, you know, it's in within walking distance of where they have to go, and they're at the farm, which is 10 miles away, I believe, from their house. It takes about an hour to get there by car, driving nice and slow. So it's, and the school, I have no idea where the school is, except it's on the other side of the bridge. This town is all over the place.
The other thing to mention that we haven't mentioned about Ultima is that she has a pet owl. When Ultima arrived at the Mara's Luna house, the owl went and nested in a tree nearby. And the owl is very important to Ultima, obviously very, very close and near to her heart. But it also is a ill omen to a lot of the people in the town, because they suspect that it is a familiar, which is something that you would expect a witch to have, an animal that has some aspect of Ultima's being in it.
Right. They think it's Ultima's Horcrux or whatever. Yeah.
This is left up in the air through most of the book, what exactly Ultima's relationship with the owl is. But the owl, as we will soon see, does seem to do Ultima's bidding. A lot of editions of the book use the owl as the cover of the book.
The owl, it's so funny, when Ultima arrives and the owl arrives at the same time, Tony is talking about how, yeah, like you said, the rest of the town thinks of this as an ill omen, and even Tony thinks of it as a really weird and strange thing. Talks about how his father would normally just go out and shoot an owl if it was near the house. Like, that's that's a superstitious thing, I assume. I don't know.
Somewhere around here, Tony has a dream that is kind of brought about by the owl singing at night. He hears the owl singing at night and he falls asleep and he dreams about the virgin. So we have this kind of a pagan symbol of the owl blending into this Catholic symbol of the virgin. And the virgin speaks to his mother, whose name is Maria. So she, of course, has a relationship there to the virgin. Although, to be fair, half the women in Mexico, I think, are named Maria.
That's correct, yes.
And the virgin promises that the three brothers that have been off in the war will return home safely. And Maria asks whether Antonio will become a priest. And in his dream, Antonio sees the virgin wearing mourning clothes while standing on the moon. These dreams are not particularly subtle.
That's a mysterious symbolism. I don't understand. No. Yeah.
But that's the way this book rolls. And there are a lot of these dreams. They're very helpfully put in italics, by the way. So you can always tell when Antonio has fallen asleep because everything suddenly switches over to italics.
Just like my dreams. I think from that part, we get the introduction of his friends because he's going to church. This ragtag group of other children who have interesting names like Horse and Vitamin Kid. What? I don't even know where a nickname like that would come from.
Wasn't he supposed to be the kid who could run faster than anyone?
Yeah, that was definitely his thing. He was the fastest, and literally no one could beat him. Like, they didn't know how he was so fast. But and reading that part, hearing the friends, you know, it, like, eventually, after each friend is kind of introduced in a way, making their commentary, you know, saying words like, I don't know if you believe about these kind of things, but, you know, chingada and just commentary that people are saying. It's like, these are eventually the people other than, say, a Horse and Jason and a couple of other ones just become background noises. Like, every time somebody says something, you know, it's like in the background, chingada.
One of the things that's hilarious is he's got a friend named Jason Chavez, and Jason Chavez knows a local Indian who is called Jason Chavez's Indian.
Yeah.
That's all he's ever referred to in the book. And that's what... One thing that happened also when, in addition to when the owl landed on the tree when Ultima came to visit the family, when Ultima arrived at Tony's house, Tony felt the wind blow around him, and he feels the wind blow around him again when he's sent off to school for the first time. And of course, his first thoughts are about dust devils and whether or not this shows that Ultima has some sort of a demonic power about her. Obviously, Ultima has a power about her. Later, we will see in no uncertain terms that she has actual magical powers. But Tony is still kind of wondering about her and whether or not these powers come from good or evil. He does begin school, and this is a big deal because his mom wants him to become a priest. And so Tony feels like from a very early age, he's being groomed to enter the priesthood. And this is kind of crazy to think about from the age of six to be being. But part of it, to be fair to his mom, is she at this point doesn't even know about the safety of his older brothers, and she wants a different life for Tony. The priesthood represents an upward mobility that you can have if you come from a lower class that isn't necessarily available any other way.
Yeah, and she's also talking about the first of the Lunas, which that is one of the Lunas, one of the ancestors that she's most proud of, that the family is most proud of, was a priest. But Tony brings up at a certain point, well, if he was a priest, how is this family still going on? Because obviously a priest is chaste. They can't do that. And then it becomes something they don't talk about. She'd be happy if he just became a learned man. You know, she really wants a priest, but she wants a learned man. And I feel like this, she has his plan, future planned, or she really, really wants this for him. And his father comes off as defeated in this. And I feel like that comes from not because of the mother, but because of his three older brothers also not following the father's path of caballero, you know, on the llano. No, nobody wants this life. I feel really bad for the dad.
Now, speaking of the three brothers, Antonio has a dream in which his three brothers are giants, and they ask him, his brothers ask Tony to save them because they are dying. And when he wakes up, his brothers are home. It's an odd dream insofar as it seems to be a portent of bad times for the brothers, but the brothers show up. Almost immediately, however, it becomes apparent that the brothers have been greatly changed by the war. They are given to drink. They are given to womanizing. They are restless. They have no interest in staying in Guadalupe. They certainly have no interest in the farm. They speak openly about wanting to go to California. He has another dream in which the brothers are going into Rosie's and are telling Tony, come in, you know, you need to come in and become a man too. It's all highly psychosexual.
This kid is six. Well, his examples of adulthood are for the most part miserable. I see his mother as possibly the only one who seems happy for the most part, but she is also, she's just, she has fits of, you know, oh, it's terrible, oh, and, you know, and the, which immediately goes into, oh, it's wonderful, this is happening. And his other examples are father, who, like I said, drinks. He's got Narciso is the name of the one I couldn't remember, who is the town drunk, but is also seems very wise and, but also seems unhappy. We've got the three brothers. They come back into town and they aren't who, you know, they're not the respectful people that Antonio is. Like, Antonio is a good son when it comes to parental expectations. He's very respectful. He doesn't speak unless he's spoken to. He doesn't argue. The brothers come back and they are full of the need to get out to live their own lives and not be controlled by their parents. So once again a poor father is like, oh, we're going to California. Yeah, we're going to move. You guys are going to help me. This is what's going to happen. They're like, sure, Dad. We'll think about that. And then they run off to Vegas, except for Andrew. And that's right. Another example of like, oh, is it okay to just disappoint your parents? I mean, I wish I could hang out with my brothers. I'm a six-year-old kid who saw somebody murdered earlier. Yeah. Of course, there's Ultima, who, I mean, she is obviously the book is named after her, so it's she's going to be the most presentable adult.
This is where Antonio graduates from his first year of school, and he's being promoted from first to third grade because he's so smart. I kind of worry a lot about Antonio here because that's not necessarily a great thing to have happen to you.
Children are mostly terrible. This is something we see in the book for the most part, with the exception of a few people like Hassan and who's the other kid who is really who's trying to teach Tony it's okay to believe other things.
At this point, Andrew tells him the story of the carp, but maybe you're thinking of the one that whose name
Samuel.
There's Florence, who is a kid who has had a very sad childhood, whose parents both died, and his older sisters are now working at Rosie's, and he doesn't believe in Catholicism, and that scandalizes young Tony. But at this point in the story is when we are introduced to this myth of the golden carp. Actually, you're right. It's Samuel who tells him about the golden carp.
Right.
And he heard the story from Jason Chavez's Indian.
This character that we don't actually meet in the book,
right,
but is talked about in the way a kid would talk about this mythical feature. Oh, he's got this Indian. It's his Indian.
If you put the carp mythology forward as an alternative to Catholicism, what's interesting to me about it is it sort of seems to spring up out of the ground. All the different kids ask Antonio if he's ever fished for carp. There's a legend that it's bad luck to catch carp, and Samuel explains why it's bad luck to catch carp when he tells a story about the golden carp. But it's sort of like no one single person owns all of the story. It's sort of like it just percolates up out of the soil.
Yeah.
And I think that's very much a deliberate choice. If Anaya is trying to contrast Catholicism with this indigenous paganism, what's kind of the difference is that Catholicism has a clear line of authority, and it's something imposed on this group of people from afar, from Europe, ultimately, whereas the legend of the golden carp, no one's quite sure where it comes from.
It makes sense that it would be told in pieces from person to person as like oral tradition and something that isn't written down. We don't have a book about the legend of the carp. We don't have... and they say, when they talk about this golden carp, it is one of the gods. It is not the god in this story either. So I feel like there is an even bigger story that whether it's coming from Hassan's Indian or just like you said, it sprung up from the ground, tales that the kids are telling out of school. You know, it's the firmness of Catholicism versus the relaxed nature of the golden carp is important. It gives Antonio a peace that he can't get going to church. And it's kind of beautiful, especially the way it's written in the book, describing the clear water and the fish and the appearance. Because when Samuel takes him to see, he literally takes him to see the golden carp. It's not a fictional thing. It's not like La Llorona, which you're not going to see unless you're, you know, drunk or something like that, or watching HBO late at night. He goes, he takes him to the secret pond that nobody can know about unless Samuel or Cecil takes him to see, or probably Hassan. Hassan, even though he gets mentioned a bunch of times in the book, I don't think he actually gets much written time. But this is a literal thing, a literal gigantic golden beautiful carp that they can see and splashes in the water, at least. That's what they say in the book. But in comparison, and this is a struggle that Antonio just can't comprehend, and I think that anyone who grew up a Christian can probably relate to, trying to understand where God is, where the answers that God is giving to adults that are constantly talking about the voice of God or the feeling, the answers are going to be there. It's an important part.
This is the part of the book where we get to see just how powerful Ultima is, mm-hmm. because this is the section where Tony's mother's brother, so Tony's uncle, Lucas Luna, is near death. He's fallen sick, and nothing any of the doctors can do can help him.
The priests, the doctors, yeah.
It turns out that Lucas has seen the three daughters of Tenorio, who runs the bar in town, dancing a black mass. So this is a world in which there actually are witches, bruja.
Yeah, literal witches.
Literal witches. And he chased them off with a cross. Lucas chased them off with a cross he made, and then he fell ill under a curse. Ultima says that she will lift the curse. She takes Tony to the town of El Puerto. There's a very elaborate ritual that Ultima has to do. She produces this healing potion that Lucas has to drink, and that it causes him to spit up and throw up, and Ultima has to collect the spittle. She also makes these sort of totemic clay dolls that are, you know, the reader obviously knows represent the three daughters of Tenorio. And it's a very complicated and painful process, but Lucas eventually ends up feeling better and able to eat. And as you said, it's interesting that the Lunas, who in some ways are the most Catholic family in the book, have come to her for help. And they're happy for her help, but they also are very suspicious of her help. Obviously, she's performed something magical here, but whether that means she's a witch as well is kind of an open question.
Yeah, there is the details of what happens in there. Did you notice there's a part where Antonio obviously goes along with Ultima when she has to do this uncursing of his uncle? And the reason why she takes him, or at least what she says, is because he's a Juan. You know, his middle name, he's Antonio Juan Mares. And I don't know what they meant by that. I wonder if that is an important detail.
Yeah, I have no idea. That's a good question.
Yeah. But the other thing that happens besides her curing him of the curse and setting up future events is that before she goes to help his uncle, she goes straight to Tenorio, whose daughters are the ones who are responsible for this curse. And he owns a bar and hangs out there in town. And she goes directly to him to confront him and say, This is your last chance. If you don't get your daughters to take this curse off of Antonio's uncle, I'm not responsible for what happened. They are the ones who messed with human life or the lifeline. She says something very specific about if you mess with life the way that they did, that there are going to be terrible consequences no matter what. So... And, of course, Tenorio is calling her a witch and saying, I'm not going to do anything like that. You get out of here. And she pulls kind of a Gandalf in the first Lord of the Rings movie where everything like goes dark around her. It's like a display of magic to be like, oh, you're not scared of me. You should be, which I like. And Tenario tries to run her down on the way. They head back to the farm where the uncle is, and he tries to run her down with a horse and almost kills Antonio in the process. This poor kid. But, you know, that is the avalanche. That is the beginning of that stone that rolling downhill, because I almost feel like if Ultima hadn't gone and confronted Tenario, like, right to his face, that maybe parts of the rest of the book just would have been avoided, because eventually he would have found out how, something terrible was happening to his daughters. I'm sure rumors would have spread around that Ultima was responsible, but this was like, I'm doing this. I'm going to fix this. There's nothing you can do, sir.
I think this is actually around the time that is it Chicho?
Ciso?
Ciso. I'm sorry. I apologize for my Spanish. Ciso brings Antonio to see the golden carp. Added to the story of the golden carp is the story of a siren, kind of a mermaid in the pond where the carp is, that lures people to their death. Mm-hmm. This is reflected in a dream that Antonio has, where he dreams about the waters of the lake and the waters of the ocean, and he hears his father talking about how Antonio belongs to the ocean, and his mother says that he belongs to the lake, and then Ultima comes in the dream and says, "You're just seeing parts of the same thing." And it's interesting that this, again, this is a pretty blatant statement of the theme of the book, of the way in which of one way in which you can seek to bring together these disparate elements of Catholicism and paganism. But it comes here right at the center of the book, it doesn't seem to make life any easier for Tony after this dream.
No, his life doesn't. As you know, this is all mostly his internal monologue. It's all told from his point of view, and it's just a constant roaring conflict. No matter what, I can only assume that Ultima is sitting over him while he's sleeping, constantly applying things to, because she does that. She'll apply things to his forehead to like calm his fever and you know, calm his dreams. And when she intercepts into this particular dream, being that we've established that she has powers, I wouldn't be surprised if she like literally invaded his dreams. And in order to calm this storm that was going on, and it is to no avail.
Well, speaking of Ultima's powers, right after this is when Tenorio's first daughter becomes ill and then dies. It seems to be a side effect of the lifting of the curse, and probably why she went to Tenorio to try and get him to have the daughters remove the curse themselves. Perhaps this would not have been a side effect. This could have been avoided. But Tenorio basically leads a lynched mob to Tony's house, saying that Ultima is a witch. They come up with a test. Narciso, the town drunk, who also seems to be attuned to the world of magic, understands this folk way that if you put blessed needles around a door, and I didn't know this was even a thing, but you can get priests to bless needles, then a witch cannot pass through that door. And
I don't know how legitimate that is. I don't.
Right. And the mob seems to placate the mob, but Tenorio is not happy with this. And at this point, Ultima's owl comes down and gouges out one of his eyes. And while the crowd is looking at what's happening with Tenorio, when they look back, Ultima has gone through the door one way or another.
Yeah.
And this seems to be good enough for the crowd, in spite of the fact that an owl just obviously gouged out a guy's eyes.
Listen, we all thought she was a witch. She's obviously not a witch. And this was just some sort of free coincidence. Owls, you know, they're dangerous. That's why you shoot them. Always ripping out people's eyeballs.
Tony notices, and no one else seems to, that the needles are gone from the door. So it is kind of left up in the air, you know, to what extent Ultima has to abide by the rules surrounding witchcraft or not, and whether that bodes well or ill for her,
yeah,
for her ultimate goodness. I think we're all used to today in our fantasy and science fiction with dealing with these figures who may be forces for good, but perhaps their power comes from a place that's not so good. And I wouldn't say that Ultima is that, but I think that Anaya leaves it kind of open for your own interpretations.
Yeah. Well, she goes to church. She is seen praying with a mother. She is, Ultima comes off as a Catholic herself, but yeah, they have to draw a line between if you're a witch, you have to be bad, even if Ultima is a witch, this whole good and evil thing that Antonio is struggling with all the time, it's the shades of gray that Ultima is trying to show him. I think that's part of it too. I think probably she is a witch, and how does the holy water cross or the blessed needle cross thing work? If she knocked it out of the door, if someone else knocked it out of the door, could she even touch those things? I don't know.
Around this time, there is a Christmas pageant. It's kind of played for laughs in the book because there is a big snowstorm and a nearby school for girls that was going to send some girls over to participate in the pageant with the boys. They can't make it, and so the boys all have to play the girls' roles. I'll just say that for me, this was a kind of a passage of the book that kind of fell a little flat for me. I think it was a tempting humor, but it never really struck me as very funny. What did you think?
No, I totally agree with that. It kind of stops the flow of the book because it is like we've got a little rascal scene going on here where we get to see Tony's friends. We get to see Horse and Red and Vitamin Kid all acting like brats to this poor teacher. But it also struck me as familiar once again because I was a kid once and I was probably just as terrible. the thing that threw me off about this whole sequence is the snow. Because, like I said, I live in Southern California. I've lived in Southern California all my life, and we don't have snow over here. I can remember it snowing one time when I was a kid, and it was a big deal, but the snow only lasted for about 2 days. And, like, I guess it must snow in New Mexico. Like, I know it snows where my brother lives in Utah, so I guess it's not that weird. But for some reason, I just can't put that in my brain as like, oh yeah, it's perfectly fine that it snows there because we're living on the Llano here, you know, we're vaqueros, we're Catholics.
I was wondering about that myself, whether this was supposed to be some sort of a magical, mystical occurrence, because again, this is a book in which crazy, magical things happen, and people tend to kind of brush them off. That's one of the things that always left me puzzling, is why people accept one thing that Ultima does, but sees another thing that she does as over the line somehow. And the snowfall falls into that category. But it also sets up the big scene between Narciso and Tenorio.
Yeah.
Another one of his daughters is sick. He announces loudly to everyone that he's going to kill Ultima, and Narciso confronts him. And of course, Antonio has just the worst luck. He happens to be out in the middle of nowhere, and he gets to watch the fight between Narciso and
Tenorio.
Tenorio, and Tenorio shoots him.
It's hard to remember Tenorio's name because it doesn't really. That's not a common name you hear anywhere. I've got three uncles named Tenorio, but no, that's not true.
Oh, you do?
No, I don't.
Now, there's a dream sequence here again where after Narciso has been killed, Antonio makes his way home. He's having a fever because he's been out in the snow, and he has a dream where he begs God and the Virgin to save Narciso.
Curse Tenorio.
Yeah, and to curse Tenorio, and the Virgin says that she will forgive Narciso if Antonio forgives Tenorio.
That is such a crazy and complicated thing that as a child I remember. I wasn't brought up Catholic or anything like that. I was brought up a United Methodist. But the concept of forgiveness, that it belongs to everybody, and even your worst enemy deserves forgiveness in the eyes of, you know, we're taught, you know, in the eyes of Christ, everything can be forgiven. And, like, this spoke to me in high school, because I think I was dealing with a lot of feelings about, you know, what is my religion really telling me? Like, God, did God make these rules? If, you know, the whole, why does bad things happen to good people type thing? And who deserves to be saved? As if, like, a human has the ability to decide who gets to be saved. And, like, I just want to say this just one more time. This kid is 6 years old. He just saw another person get killed in front of him. There was also a part when, when Narciso gets murdered by Tenorio, he once again, just as Lupito did, asks Antonio to hear his confession, to read him his last rites. And Antonio, I think, handles it slightly better this time. But he is once again like, I'm not a priest. There's not enough time to get a priest. What am I supposed to do?
The dream goes on with everyone that Tony knows, including himself, being killed, with the town falling into the lake, and basically with Armageddon. So the kid is... He has strong feelings. He does get better from the pneumonia, and one of the things that happens when he is back up and about is he learns that the town coroner has called Narciso's death
a suicide.
so no one really cares much for Narciso.
Narciso shot himself twice in the chest. Sure.
But Tony hopes, because he's coming up on his first communion. He's been told that when he receives his communion, everything will make sense in his life, and he will understand why there's good and evil in the world. And so he's really looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's a lot of promises. I don't...
That's a lot.
Nobody told me that when I took my first communion.
Tenorio shows up again. I think at this point in the book, Tenorio is just kind of like hiding out in the bushes for the rest of the book, and just popping up and shouting at Tony. Why Tenorio doesn't just shoot Tony? Because he's already shown himself to have no compunction about taking life. I don't know, but he basically keeps threatening Tony because I guess his third daughter is now ill.
And he saw Tony with Ultima in the beginning when he was confronted. So he knows he's, you know, keeps accusing Tony of just being her lackey and lackey of the Bruja, that kind of stuff like that. Poor Tony.
We're treated to some more exploration of Tony's understanding of Catholic theology. To be fair to Catholicism, I don't think that the priest Father Burns, mm-hmm. Is a very good advocate for the faith. Tony's friend Florence, as I mentioned before, who doesn't believe in the Catholic Church because he's had this terrible life, and he basically calls into question sort of the whole idea of cosmic justice, whether or not he actually wants to worship a God that has let his parents die and his sisters fall into a life of prostitution. So he tells Tony and the group of friends he can't take First Communion because he won't go to confession, because he doesn't believe he ever did anything wrong, which, of course, scandalizes everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sequence where the kids are all going to beat up on Florence, and Tony says, I'll forgive him his sins. And so they all decide they're going to beat up Tony instead.
And he's being one of those kids that you have to teach a lesson for. Obviously, everybody seems to also know that Tony is being pushed towards being a priest, too. That's something people are making fun of. And he seems like a quiet kid who asks a lot of questions about faith and stuff like that. But yeah, kids picking on him. Florence, though, I feel really bad for him, too. There's a lot of people in this book to feel bad for.
Why was it you wanted this book again?
I was just looking for something light and fun.
First Communion comes, and Antonio doesn't receive any kind of answer to the questions he has for God about whether or not all these people that he's seen killed are now in heaven or hell, you know, about the truth of the golden carp or of Ultima. Communion has done nothing for him, and he finds it quite unsettling. Now, there's a final demonstration of Ultima's powers. Ultima is asked by a local rancher to come help exorcise a house that seems to be filled with unruly spirits who keep throwing things off the shelves at people. It turns out when Ultima comes to the house that there's a history to this house, that many, many years ago the grandfather, the owner of the house, had killed three Comanche Indians, hanging them and just kind of left them up there instead of obeying the Comanche death rituals, which require the cremation of the bodies. So that is how you get restless ghosts, you know? It's like an archer. That's how you get ants. This is how you get ghosts.
Well, Tenorio also knew this, so apparently he's the one who stirred them up in the first place.
Yeah, it's kind of like the plot line to the new Ghostbusters, that there's some guy out there like stirring up these restless spirits. We don't know what he did to get them riled up, but they're riled up. The guy who owns the house is a guy named Tellez, and he said that he had confronted Tenorio over basically dissing Ultima in the bar.
Jeez, man, nobody can get away with anything for this guy.
Yeah, he draws a line in the sand. Mm-hmm.
What did you say about the condition of my bathroom? You are cursed.
Basically, by having a kind of a surrogate cremation, Ultima burns three bundles on a pyre. We're not told what's in the bundles, but that puts the spirits to rest.
This one happens way faster than with the uncle. This felt like Ultima showed up and was like, I know exactly what to do. Let's do this. Bam.
Well, you know, sometimes you just get the right person for the job.
Oh, yeah. This is, okay, I've done this 100 times before. Florence is, as we said before, he does not believe in the Catholic God, and actually he's one of the nicer kids, and it seems like Cecil and Samuel have been picking the nicer, more intelligent kids and introducing them to the Golden Carp. So this summer, they're going to be showing Florence the Golden Carp, and Antonio puts a lot of stock behind this. But then, you know, fate steps in.
They all go to the lake where the carp is, and Florence apparently went swimming without the other kids, or maybe he was called by this mermaid that we've been told about that calls people to their death, because he's found floating in the lake. Now, this is horrific, but there is this kind of a funny moment where they say the kids go and get a lifeguard, and I just was thinking, a lifeguard? Mm-hmm. What, there's a lifeguard here? It just seems so completely out of character with the rest of what I've been told about this town.
Well, they're not at the Golden Carp Lake. The Golden Carp Lake's a little bit farther away, but there's one side of the lake that they're supposed to swim on, and I think that was like the maybe closer to town or something like that. So that's why we've got the lifeguard over there. And they went to the other side where there is, like, you can see a bunch of junk sticking out of there, so it's dangerous, and that's what happens.
So at this point, Antonio has seen Lupito, Narciso, and Florence die pretty much in front of him. Florence, not in front of him, but he saw his
dead
body.
So that's good enough.
So he's concerned about the state of each of these people's immortal souls. And so at this last dream sequence, Tony sees Lupito, Narciso, and Florence, and they say that by Tony praying an act of contrition for them, they're okay. And Tony says, why is the world violent? And they say that's because that's how creation works, is that it's that you can't have creation without destruction, which again is pretty sophisticated theology for a 7-year-old's unconscious mind to come up with.
He's always looking for answers. All he has to do is go to sleep. I mean, that everything he needs to know eventually gets told to him in his dreams anyways.
Ultima tells Tony that he needs to go spend some time with his uncles, because she can see that Tony is starting to become a nervous wreck. And she thinks that it will be good for him to spend... It's not as though they were in the big city, but, you know, to go from the country to the deep country, I guess, will do him some good.
Yeah, the farm is a place that, for some reason, is disconnected from everything else, even though, yeah, like we said, it's only about 10 miles away.
Tony is accompanied to his uncle's house by his father, and Gabrielle and Antonio have a kind of a little heart-to-heart, and Tony realizes that he identifies more closely with his Mares side than his Luna side. They have a little discussion about the nature of evil in the world, and Gabrielle says that he doesn't actually believe in evil. He just thinks that there are things we don't understand, and those are the things we label as evil. And I think that's a lovely sentiment, except that we've just seen Denario curse some people.
Yes, and murder some people, and they're I don't know. I don't... is it evil that he shot Narciso? Maybe we just don't understand. <That's>...
Tony spends some time with his uncles. At the end of the summer, Tenorio's final daughter dies, and now he's really on the warpath, as if he weren't on the warpath before. I think that this is something that Anaya doesn't really handle that well, is that we're supposed to see this as sort of a mounting threat,
right,
through the book, but Tenorio kind of comes out the gate as a big threat, and he's just kind of like there on the periphery of everything that's happening for the second half of the book, and I don't know why people aren't more concerned about him than they are, but now we're told that he is going to kill Ultimo one way or another, and because that Tony wants to go home and he wants to take his uncle Pedro wants to come with him. The geography of this confuses me a little bit because I don't really have a good idea how far Guadalupe is from La Puerta.
Yeah.
And for some reason, Pedro is going to drive back to Guadalupe and Antonio is going to walk back to Guadalupe.
Well, he doesn't intend to at first. It's after he hears that they're intending to go back to Guadalupe together that day, but when the other uncle comes into the field and explains that, oh, Tenorio is going to go over and do it right now, Antonio takes it upon himself to run. And this is like a fever dream to me, this sequence, because, it doesn't... The distance he covers, how tired he must have been, the day transitioning to nighttime, nothing is really clear at this point. Unfortunately, the ending of the book feels rushed to me. We're just like rushing towards this conclusion.
Tenorio runs into Antonia out in the... out in the fields outside of Guadalupe, tries to trample him with his horse. I don't know why. He gives one attempt, then he gives up and runs off. Again,
it's just bonus points.
Right. Tenorio is very, very dangerous to everyone except for Antonio. Tenorio decides he's going to go for Ultima where it hurts, which is her owl. And he does. He gets to the Mares Luna house and shoots the owl, but the owl doesn't the owl get his other eye before that happens?
No, I don't think so. I think because he after he shoots the owl, he's able to track down Tony finally, who has run all the way to the Luna home just in time to see another loved person potentially die.
Right. Right. And Tenorio is now he's finally going to do what he should have done all along and shoot Tony, but before he can, his uncle Pedro shoots him. So it is a kind of a mess, I think, from a standpoint of trying to picture what's happening. I think if this were filmed, you could probably work it out. You know, a good director could work out this action and edit together to make sense. But it's the sort of thing that I think on the page is a little hard to follow.
Yeah.
So Tenorio is dead. The owl is dying. And Tony takes the owl to Ultima, who says, yeah, too bad. Now, when the owl dies, I am going to die too. And we just all kind of accept that, you know, like nothing seems to be wrong with Ultima at the moment, but she's like, no, I'll be dead soon. Yep. And she tells him that when she was a young Curandera, she was tied to the owl as a source of power. And she was told by her teacher about this this rule of you can't meddle with people's destinies, because if you do, it'll come back to bite you. But it's good that that she's going to die, because this is going to put an end to this cycle of cursing and uncursing, causing all these weird side effects.
Now, who's left? Jeez, at this point.
Well, not her. Yeah. But but this is where we get the titular bless me, Ultima, is Tony asks for a blessing before she dies, and she does bless him in the name of all that is good and strong and beautiful, and she gives him a few instructions about what to do about burning all of her possessions, which, you know, seems again like a kind of a sad thing. I mean, like, I know she's gonna die, but do we have to lose all her stuff? And Tony buries the owl. Now, this is the end of the book. Yep. And if it sounds a little like it ends on a down note, it sort of does and it sort of doesn't. I think that one of the great things about the way this book is written is tonally, Anaya is able to make this into kind of a triumph of spirit for Ultima, that, you know, she was able through this death to at least bring some sort of a balance to this disturbed, I guess she brings balance to the Force, just like Anakin.
That's correct.
But I mean, what did you think about reading this again now as an adult?
Reading it this time, the book reminded me of another book, The Alchemist, by Paulo Coelho, I believe his name is, which is also written very simply. That sounds like I'm putting down the writing of these two books. It's not. There's nothing wrong with being written simply. It's just an easy read that isn't complicated by symbolism in more dense books. And this one, like I said, when in high school, it seemed like I could relate to a lot of things that was going on to the character in this book. And as an adult, I can reflect upon my own childhood and my youth and see the way Antonio is interacting with people, interacting with his parents, interacting with his friends. And he's kind of he's almost a misfit because he's stuck in between the Mares and the Luna clan and trying to figure all these things out as he's growing up on top of everything. And I just, the way it's all laid out, I think is really beautiful. It's considered a coming of age tale, obviously. And I think it is a pretty good fit for that time period, you know, as your podcast is called, Sophomore Lit. I feel like a high school age, or maybe even younger, that this is kind of an appropriate book about growing up, about experiencing things. Although I'm not sure how much it teaches you about literature, the way things were written. See, I'm going over my own head here. I don't even know.
As a non-Chicano, as a white reader, an interested white reader who has a smattering of knowledge of Mexican history, I can't help but want to read this all allegorically about the way in which the Mexican identity is so strongly drawn between indigenous and European traditions. And I do know that the revolution that took place in 1910, that one of the things that it really sought to ameliorate was a kind of a class system based upon favoritism towards people of European descent, by kind of saying that the Mexican character, it sort of explicitly sought as a cultural revolution to see the Mexican character as a blended character. While this is a book about Mexican Americans, it certainly is about that tension between the Native American traditions versus the Catholic traditions, and it comes down, you know, pretty solidly on the idea of why not both, like the meme says. But on the other hand, that strikes me as a little bit difficult to support in some ways by the text, because in every case in this book where Catholicism could come through for someone, it seems to not come through for someone. You know, it doesn't help people with their curses. It causes people a lot of anxiety around the sort of state of their soul. It causes the children to beat up on each other. Whereas this religion of the land that Ultima and Gabrielle subscribe to seems to actually have efficacy. I remember reading in Jorge Amado, and Jorge Amado, of course, is Brazilian, and so we're dealing with a completely different culture there. But if you read Donna Flor and Her Two Husbands, that book also has this interesting interplay between the indigenous gods of the Amazon versus Catholic theology. I think that book more explicitly melds the two in a way that felt satisfying to me, whereas this book, I feel like the attempt is made, but I feel like if I were Tony, I would just like chuck the priesthood and go learn to go find Ultima's teacher somewhere and do that.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of answers there that he is not getting very clear from the Catholic Church in this point. You know, we didn't really talk about, we kind of just barely touched on the influences that this book, or possibly just the lifestyle at the time, had on other people. And when you brought up Palomar, which is that Gabriel Hernandez or the other brother?
That's Beto Hernandez.
And I did not put that together, which is funny because I'm such a huge Love and Rockets fan, and I've read most of the Palomar stories. That, and now that you've said it, it is that view into this world where people are religious, but they're also very spiritual, and it's violent, and it seems like it would be so terrifying and wild, and I don't know. it leaves me speechless thinking about it. I feel the book is something good to read because of the way it talks about spirituality, the connection between spirituality and the earth, and how complicated and simple life is at the same time, and how good you had it as a 6-year-old. It could have been so much worse. Okay, that's all I have to say about that.
Thanks again to Joel Torres. His podcast is called Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space. Thanks for the music, as always, to Malcolm Nygaard. You can follow his podcast and other goings-on at epochgraffiti.com. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more smart, funny podcasts at theincomparable.com. You can email me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Someone else got the Sophomore Lit address. Join us on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page, where we discuss the books we read as teens, the books we're reading now, and pretty much anything. The conversation wanders. And, as always, everything will be on the final.